of suffering is the attachment to a presumed, limited, and mortal identity, and to the beliefs and images that emanate from and reinforce that presumption. If someone were to take that definition and apply it to conflict, they would be able to understand what is going on to a far greater degree. The real enemy is not someone or something outside of us. The real enemy is the unexamined and dualistic mind that unconsciously projects its suffering onto the other and then blames and scapegoats the other for its suffering. So to a very large extent, the battle between pro-Palestinians and pro-Israelis is a battle between consciousness and unconsciousness.
That's Richard Forer, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Forer on Blaming the Victim, Roots of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Blaming the victim is as old as the hills. It occurs when the victim of a crime or tragedy is held at fault for the harm that befell them. In other words, you had it coming to you. The great scholar Edward Said ruefully remarked that the Palestinians were the victims of the victim. Hence, it was very difficult for them to generate support. Said quoted Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. The conquest of the earth, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. What redeems it is the idea. From the Palestinian perspective, in the wake of the Holocaust, they were paying for the crimes of Europeans. Our guest today is Richard Forer. He's spent time in the West Bank and Gaza and has Orthodox Jewish relatives living in West Bank settlements. He's a former member of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the influential lobby. He's the author of the New York Big Book Award, Wake Up and Redeem Your Humanity, on the tragedy of Israel-Palestine. I talked with him at the Boulder Public Library in mid-September. And now, Richard Forer. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you, David.
Families are always an interesting place to start. They're such fertile ground. You were born in Trenton, New Jersey. Tell me about your parents. Did they have strong political views?
Everybody in my family, both my mother's side and my father's side, were liberal Democrats. My uncle was the founder of the National Lawyers Guild and the lawyer for the Communist Party. And many of them were kind of atheists. I wouldn't say they were pure atheists, but as for me, I attended Reform Synagogue from the time I was 5 years old through age 14, and I went to Saturday and Sunday schools. Summers I usually spent up until about age 12 at Jewish Community Center camps, and I had a lot of Jewish friends and a lot of non-Jewish friends. I grew up in a neighborhood that was not Jewish.
And did your folks and your siblings have views about Israel?
People call me an ex-Zionist. I never thought of myself as a Zionist. The subject was never discussed. The only thing I ever heard discussed was the Holocaust, because every Jewish family I knew, including one of my best friends, had members who'd been killed in the Holocaust. When I say one of my best friends, his father had escaped one of the concentration camps by killing a Nazi guard, and they both showed me their brands that had been branded into their forearms. And that was very significant. I was like 10 years old when they showed me. The thing I would hear at synagogue a lot, after Saturday services, for example, I'd hear the men talking, and they would say things like, I'm like 10 or 11 years old, but I remembered it. They would say things like, if a nuclear bomb is going to explode somewhere in the world, it's going to start in the Middle East. And thank God the Arabs are not united. They can never get it together. So that's why they're not able to destroy Israel. Except then Gamal Abdel Nasser came along. And Nasser was a pan-Arabist, and he was a charismatic leader. And David Ben-Gurion, the leader of Israel, referred to him as Hitler on the Nile. And that made a big impression on me, because we had photographs of Ben-Gurion and Chaim Weizmann in our Sunday school, Saturday school classes. Chaim Weizmann was the first president of Israel. And I saw these older wise men protecting the Jews from another Holocaust. That's kind of how I looked at it. And so when Nasser came along and was referred to as the Hitler on the Nile, that evoked images of concentration camps, of another Holocaust, and it really influenced how I felt about the subject of Israel-Palestine. Plus, when you read the Old Testament, the Jews are always fighting with one tribe or another, one nationality or another. So it really all played a large role in how I developed my views. Plus, I experienced some anti-Semitism growing up.
You use the term Zionism. What is Zionism?
Okay, Zionism is a political movement. It's a nationalist ideology whose goal is the establishment of a Jewish state. However, Zionism was based on the premise that where Jews go, anti-Semitism erupts. So the ideology of Zionism requires, not only it requires a Jewish state, but it requires the expulsion of non-Jews because they're presumed to be anti-Semites. And so, for example, the U.S. State Department in 1943 said about Zionism, Zionism is a nationalist ideology that refers to Judaism as both a religion and a nationality, and its ideology is based on blood and soil, much like the Nazis. And this was in 1943. Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, the great philosopher, and 26 other Jews wrote a letter in the New York Times in 1948 calling the revisionist stream of Zionism, that's the right wing of Zionism. That was the Vladimir Jabotinsky, whose secretary was Benjamin Netanyahu's father. The revisionists were right wing. The David Ben-Gurion wing were more like socialists. Anyway, Einstein called the revisionist wing and the Herut party, which is now called Likud, which is today's ruling party, he called them fascists and terrorists. And Einstein said, I hope the Jews don't do to the Palestinians what the Nazis did to the Jews. So Zionism is kind of a malignant ideology that has grown out of control because it's not just nationalistic, it presumes that Jews are a superior people to everybody else.
On October 24th, a little more than 2 weeks after the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, and I'm quoting, "It's important to also recognize the attacks by Hamas did not happen in a vacuum." Go to what Secretary General Guterres said and the importance of context.
Yeah, the context is everything because, first of all, what are the Palestinians supposed to do? Every time they have demonstrated nonviolently, Israel has crushed them. The two most prominent situations were the First Intifada, which began in 1987, and in the first year of the First Intifada, the Palestinians, depending on the source, whether you look at B'Tselem, which is the Israeli Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, or Al-Haq, Law on the Service of Man, between 0 and 6 Israelis were killed in the first year of the First Intifada, while Israel killed more than 200 Palestinians, imprisoned thousands, deliberately broke the bones of demonstrators, according to the instructions of Chief of Staff Yitzhak Rabin, and also deported and imprisoned every single leader of civil disobedience and nonviolence among the Palestinian people. And then throughout their history, the Palestinians have always been suppressed. Israel needs the world to see the Palestinians as a violent people. So, for example, during the First Intifada, Israel made sure, while imprisoning or deporting all of the leaders of nonviolence, they armed Hamas and allowed Hamas's leader, Sheikh Yassin, to hand out anti-Semitic hate literature calling for the overthrow of the Jewish state. That they allowed, but they didn't allow nonviolent demonstrations at all. And then you come to 2018, of course, the period in between 87 and 2018 has really been a series of mostly nonviolent resistance. But in 2018, the Palestinians created the Great March of Return in Gaza. And it was kind of like a picnic, but the Gazans, 70 to 80% of whom are refugees, who attended the Great March of Return, were calling on Israel to allow them to return to the homes their families were kicked out of in 1948 and 1967. And they were also calling on Israel to treat them like human beings. So what did Israel do? Israel had highly trained snipers stationed beyond the fence separating Israel and Gaza, behind large earth mounds, shooting people. And they killed 57 people that day, including children, and they wounded over 3,000. And they used bullets that were fabricated to maim people for life. So they would shoot at people's legs. And then because Israel wouldn't allow the people out of Gaza to get modern medical care, and because Israel doesn't allow a lot of medical equipment into Gaza, a lot of these people had to have their legs amputated who might have avoided that. So the day after this first day of the March of Return, the IDF tweeted, and they eventually removed this because they realized how stupid it was to say this, the IDF tweeted that they were able to account for every single person there, they knew what everybody was doing, and they didn't waste a single bullet. 57 dead people, 3,000 injured. So this is an example. So what is Hamas to do? They're living in extremely impoverished conditions where the children have the highest rate of diarrhea, the children under five, the highest rate of diarrhea in the world. There's a huge number of children with malnutrition. This is before October 7th, by the way. And the 93% of the water is undrinkable. What are they supposed to do? The only thing they can do, they resisted. Hamas is a resistance movement. Yes, they have used terror attacks. It's just like the IRA, the Mau Maus of Kenya, the National Liberation Front of Algeria, and many other resistance groups. Just like the Irgun, the Stern Gang, and the Haganah, the Jewish resistance groups that pioneered the use of bombs in the marketplace, drive-by shootings, bus bombs, and they were so vicious, they killed more Jews than any other demographic because they killed Jews who talked about making peace with the indigenous people. They killed Jews who did business with Arabs. They killed Jews who liked Arabs and were friends with Arabs. But the difference between the Mau Maus, the National Liberation Front, Hamas, the IRA, etc., and the Irgun, Stern Gang, and Haganah is that whereas the former were indigenous people trying to expel a foreign invader, the latter were the foreign invader trying to expel the indigenous people. So what are they supposed to do? Live their lives as third-class citizens dying, having no future? No, they had to rebel. And if you want, I can go through the statistics. They did not kill 1,200 people.
It's less than that.
Yeah, well, it's not only less than that. The Raphael Lemkin Institute for Prevention of Genocide and Israeli Social Security data says that a total of 1,139 people were killed on October 7th. 373 of them were military personnel, which under international law were legitimate targets. 36 of the 695 civilians were children, one of whom was an infant who was killed in crossfire. There's plenty of reports from Israeli soldiers who manned helicopters that day, who were in Apache helicopters and who were shooting the rockets, that they started shooting immediately at the festival that was going on, that Hamas didn't know was happening, and they were shooting indiscriminately. They were shooting, they were bombing houses, and they were bombing cars. There's photographs of charred cars. They look like charcoal. And Israel has not released their analysis, which tells me that Israel doesn't want the world to know just how many people were killed by Israel, and that Israel invoked the Hannibal Directive, which says, we don't want any of our people taken hostage. We'd rather you kill them. And the soldiers, that's what they did. They bombed the houses, they bombed the cars. So we don't know how many people were killed. I heard Scott Ritter, the former UN weapons inspector, during the Iraq war in 2003. Scott Ritter says that more than 80% of the civilians that were killed by Israel. I think it's probably somewhere in the 50% or lower range. But in any case, the media keeps repeating that Hamas killed 1,200 people. Hamas killed 1,200 people. And they did not kill that many people. Whether or not that means anything to the powers that be, whether it's, you know, 1,200 people, 600 people, you know, the point is, it was a prison break. Hamas did a prison break, really a concentration camp break. They escaped their prison and they did what they felt they needed to do. Another thing is that to the Palestinians, prisoners, of which before October 7th, there were around 9,000 in Israel, many of whom were not charged. They were under administrative detention, which can last for decades. It's very important for Hamas and for the Palestinian people to get their prisoners back. And the only way they've ever gotten prisoners back is through either kidnapping Israelis like Gilad Shalit, in 2006, who they exchanged for 1,000 prisoners, or doing what they did on October 7th, which was take hostages. That's the only way they ever get prisoners out of Israeli prisons.
You could add the African National Congress to that list.
That's
and
right.
Nelson Mandela,
right.
That were routinely described by the U.S. State Department and whoever's been sitting in the Oval Office in Washington as a terrorist organization.
Correct.
And Mandela as a terrorist. So,
right. And by the way, Hamas has made more than 15 offers since 1988 for peace. And those offers have been acknowledged by Jimmy Carter, the New York Times, the U.S. Army War College at the Strategic Studies Institute, a number of former Mossad chiefs and Shin Bet heads. Shin Bet is the Israel Security Agency. Israel will not respond to those offers because they don't want to make peace.
The UN calls Gaza a graveyard. There are 41,000 dead Palestinians, and the number is considerably higher, according to The Lancet, which is a respected British medical journal. What Israel is doing constitutes a genocide. The International Court of Justice, the ICJ in The Hague, ruled Israel was committing what it called plausible genocide. The Israeli government vehemently denies the charge of genocide, saying it is acting in self-defense in response to Hamas's October 7th attack. They say a state has the obligation to protect its citizens. So what would you say to the Israeli government official who argues that line?
I would say that Israel is doing exactly what they said they were going to do. Netanyahu, immediately after October 7th, referred to the Palestinians as Amalekites, which is a term he has used over his career, and he said, remember what Amalek did to you. Well, Amalek killed a bunch of Jews in the desert. This is in Exodus, and God told Moses to kill every last Amalekite, women and children, their sheep, their cattle, everything, totally destroy them. 200 years later or so, King Saul killed all the Amalekites except for the king. He let the king live, and then the king had a child, and then subsequently to that, Haman, who was descended from the Amalekites, wanted to destroy all the Jews of Persia. So the story, and then of course that's the book of Esther, but the point is that watch out for the Goyim, they want to kill you. Netanyahu said that we should turn Gaza into an island of ruins. Numerous members of Knesset, including Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, Netanyahu's coalition partners, called for total genocide. Rabbis were saying you have to kill everybody, no matter what their age. I did hear one rabbi say, kill all the Palestinians. You can leave the children under the age of 4. You can let them live, but kill everybody else. They're doing exactly what they said they were going to do, and they've been saying that for generations, though not as vehemently as since October 7th. So whether you call it genocide or not, the numbers speak for themselves and the conditions speak for themselves.
Israel has uncontested a very powerful military. It has nuclear weapons, which it refuses to acknowledge to be part of the non-proliferation treaty. It refuses to be part of that. Could Israel carry out what it's doing in Gaza without U.S. support?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
The United States contributes about 30% of Israel's defense budget with its billions of dollars that it gives Israel every year. And Israel would not even be able to maintain the occupation. Of course, they're helped by the Palestinian Authority, which almost every Palestinian I've met, there's been a couple exceptions, but almost every Palestinian considers them collaborators with Israel. We've seen how Israel has needed weapons from the United States just in the last 11 months. Otherwise, they would. In fact, I've heard Israeli analysts say that if the United States placed an embargo on weapons to Israel, Israel would not be able to continue this for more than a few months. And why doesn't the United States do it? It's just unbelievable they're allowing this to happen.
A little bit of history. The foundational myth of Israel is a land without people for a people without a land. But Israelis knew that that was a myth. War hero and defense minister Moshe Dayan said, "We came to a region of land that was inhabited by Arabs." Even the infamous Balfour Declaration of 1917 acknowledged that there was, quote, existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. It's interesting, they did not say the word Arab. At that time of the Balfour Declaration, the Jewish population of Palestine was 60,000. Do you know what the Arab population was?
At that time?
700,000.
Yeah.
Of course, the Jewish population then, because of immigration and what the British were doing to the Palestinian revolt from 36 to 39. And then Ariel Sharon, this is a really interesting quote, given what's going on today. He was a famous Israeli general and later became prime minister. He was asked in 1973 by a British journalist who happened to be the grandson of Winston Churchill, by the way. Churchill asked him, what would become of the Palestinians? And Sharon said, I'm quoting, we'll make a pastrami sandwich of them. We'll insert a strip of Jewish settlements in between the Palestinians, and then another strip of Jewish settlements right across the West Bank, so that in 25 years' time, neither the United Nations nor the United States, nobody will be able to tear it apart, unquote. Would you say Sharon's prediction has pretty much happened?
I would definitely say it's pretty much happened.
Well, where are we now with settlements and settlers? And I've always wondered why we're using these euphemisms as opposed to colonies and colonizers. Isn't that much more accurate?
Yes, and I consider the settlers, at least the settlers, they're mostly the ideological settlers, which means they're religious. But those settlers, I consider them terrorists. I consider the state of Israel a terrorist state because the state of Israel knows what the settlers is doing. It allows them to do it. They are protected by the Israeli Defense Forces. So, for example, if settlers go into a village and, let's say, the mothers bring their five-year-old children and teach them to throw stones and eggs at Palestinian children leaving kindergarten for the day, the soldiers just watch. If Palestinians get upset, the soldiers make sure they don't interfere. The soldiers are not even allowed to interfere with the settlers' activity. So if the settlers go in and start beating up Palestinians with bats, which they used to do, and they still do, the soldiers, sometimes they participate, but they do not interfere. The settlers are basically a de facto volunteer wing, vigilante squad of the Israel Defense Forces. And now, by the way, I don't know if you know this, the West Bank is no longer under military occupation, as it has been for decades. It is now under civilian occupation. The government of Israel turned over the administration of the occupation to Bezalel Smotrich, the head of the Religious Zionist Party, who is one of the coalition members.
And Minister of Finance.
And he wants to get rid of all of them, all of the Palestinians.
Well, these colonists are encouraged to migrate to the West Bank and are given massive tax breaks. I mean, this is state policy and housing subsidies. I mean, does this qualify as settler colonialism?
It does qualify. I mean, not only is Israel extending its settlement enterprise, there's over 100 outposts that are considered illegal under international law that Israel allows to operate, and some of them eventually become part of a settlement. They expand and then they merge into a settlement. Israel's doing nothing to stop them. It even provides them these illegal outposts with electricity and water. And by the way, so we're, as Golda Meir said, former prime minister, Israel doesn't have boundaries. Israel's boundaries are where Jews live. So that means that the boundaries of Israel extend to wherever a Jew happens to move to. So suddenly, where a Palestinian is living is not part of Israel, but then all of a sudden a Jewish settler evicts the Palestinian, and now it's part of Israel. And the Jewish settler is entitled to all the rights that Israeli civilians have within Israel proper. I don't blame any Jew who suffered through the Holocaust for wanting to live in a country where they'd never see a non-Jew again. But most Jews did not want to go to Israel. Only 3% of Israel's Jews during World War I were members of Zionist organizations. Pretty much the same percentage was true of the United States. After World War II, the survivors of Dachau concentration camp were interviewed, and a poll was taken. Only 15% of them wanted to go to Palestine at the time, and probably half of them would have returned, because that's, a lot of people who would settle, who thought they would move to Palestine. found out they didn't like it, and then they would return to Western Europe usually, or possibly even Eastern Europe. But my point is that the State of Israel would never, ever have been born without the Holocaust. Nobody would have voted for Israel to have a state of their own without the Holocaust. But most of the people who survived the Holocaust didn't want to go to Israel. They were forced to by the Zionist organizations who blocked the United States and Western Europe from taking in 100% of European Holocaust survivors.
Didn't FDR have a plan in 1944?
Correct. FDR had a plan which he got Western Europe to agree to, where they would take in 100% of the Jewish Holocaust survivors. He sent his attorney, who was Jewish, Morris Ernst, who was the founder of the ACLU. Ernst went to the Zionist groups in the United States thinking they'd be happy about this. And they called Ernst a self-hating Jew, an anti-Semite. They went crazy because they didn't want Jews coming anywhere but to Palestine, because Palestine needed enough Jewish people, enough Jewish bodies, so they could make the case for a Jewish state.
And what's happening in East Jerusalem?
The settlers are taking it over. I mean, there's all these crazy laws where if someone leaves, if a Palestinian leaves East Jerusalem for a certain number of years, then once he's out of there for that number of years, he loses total residency, the ability to live in East Jerusalem. The Jewish settlers keep taking over more and more of East Jerusalem. They use fake deeds. They claim that they have deeds from 100 years ago to houses that Palestinians have lived in for 50 years. At the end of 1948, I think it was, at the end of the 1948 war, Jordan turned over a lot of properties to Palestinians. But Jordan didn't have the sense to provide them with deeds. So these families have lived in these houses for 70 years, you know, but the Jewish settlers are coming along and just kicking them out with force, of course, and the blessing of the Israeli government.
Well, evangelical Christians are strong supporters of Israel. You write about this in your book, in particular the Reverend John Hagee of the 7 million strong Christians United for Israel. What's that about? Why are evangelical Christians such strong supporters of Israel?
Hagee believes that he has 50 million followers.
50 million.
That's what he says, yeah. Now, Hagee, who said that Hitler was a half-breed Jew who shepherded the Jews to the Holy Land, Hagee and a lot of other dispensationalists believe that Jews are guilty of the crime of killing Christ. They're guilty of the crime of deicide, which is the only unpardonable sin. This is anti-Semitism. Hitler was a Jew. Hitler was a half-breed Jew. He had to shepherd the Jews to the Holy Land because the people who didn't listen to Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, were committing crimes. Anyway, they believe in the Second Coming, okay? And for the Second Coming to happen, Israel has to be totally populated by Jews. And then when the Second Coming happens, which will happen after the Apocalypse and the Revelations or something like that, when the Second Coming happens, the Jews will either have to convert to Christianity or die in a fiery pit. There are some streams that say that 144,000 Jews will remain alive, but my guess is that they will have to convert to Christianity. But this is what they actually believe. So the Jews are happy to take their money. Christians United for Israel raises millions of dollars. In fact, Ariel Settlement, which is one of the biggest illegal settlements in Palestine, they named their convention center the John Hagee Convention Center. At the same time, they're calling Jimmy Carter, who loves the Jewish people and loved many of the Jewish leaders, he's an anti-Semite, but John Hagee, who believes that Hitler was a half-breed Jew, is revered by these people. This is how crazy the mind gets when it's filled with existential fear and confusion, which I believe are the hallmarks of separative identity.
You're listening to Richard Forer, Blaming the Victim, Roots of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Our website, alternativeradio.org. B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization, Amnesty International, and Human Rights Watch, all have determined that Israel is an apartheid state. This has barely been reported, but than the supporter of Israel might say. This is more ganging up against the Jews. They're being singled out.
They always do that. First of all, they do that because of their paranoia, because they have a belief. Again, it's instilled in them through Zionist ideology, but it's taught to them as children. From the David Ben-Gurion was an atheist. David Ben-Gurion, however, believed that the Bible was the most accurate historical document possible, and it should be taught in schools. So they're taught from the time they're children, in kindergarten, that there are all these enemies of the Jews. In fact, one woman I know who's Maya Wind, you may have heard of her. Her husband is Aaron Efrati. He was one of the, he was with Breaking the Silence and one of the spokespersons. Maya was with ICOD, Jeff Halper's group, the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolition. She told me, and she was one of the first female refuseniks. Anyway, she told me, Maya told me that beginning in kindergarten, when you go to school, above the blackboard are pictures of Israel's enemies. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Romans, blah, 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 the Palestinians. And they show them as all Jew haters, right? And even in 1985, a Jewish organization conducted an educational study of the schools, and they found that 80% of the children in these schools thought that Palestinians were dirty, 75% thought that all Arabs were terrorists, and 90% believed that the Palestinians had no right to Israel-Palestine at all. This is in 1985, when things were so much calmer than they are today. Things have only gotten worse since then.
Why is that?
It's because there's a reaction to the world becoming more and more aware of what Israel's doing to the Palestinian people. There's the internet, so people can see more clearly just what Israel is doing. The Arab countries have gotten more cohesive and organized and, you know, connected with each other, so they're able to, they're not real good, but they're able to, you know, promote the Palestinian cause. There's a lot of answers. And then existential fear. Existential fear continues to grow as their leaders continue to teach them that the world hates Jews. And also, the leaders of Israel since Menachem Begin have been more right-wing than left-wing. Menachem Begin came in, I think, in the mid-70s. And so the right-wing is definitely far more hysterical, let's say, or far more bigoted toward Palestinians. They don't have much generosity toward Palestinians. Netanyahu, if you read Netanyahu's writings or hear him talk from the time he was in his 20s, he really believes that Arabs are eternal enemies of the Jews and that they are subhuman, okay? And pretty much most of the Israeli prime ministers have said that. And then the chiefs of staff, when you read what they say, it's just horrifying.
Among the U.S. political class, there's a strong bipartisan support for Israel, with a few exceptions. Do you see any serious erosion of the U.S. position?
More than in the past, but not enough, nowhere near enough. Like, for example, when occasionally the House, Betty McCollum usually is the congresswoman from Minnesota who does this. She's a Democrat. Usually she'll put forward a resolution which they'll call maybe No Way to Treat a Child. And it says the U.S. will not give Israel any more weapons as long as they are abusing children. And the only people who ever sign on to that resolution are 100% Democrats, no Republicans. And of the Democrats, it's gotten a little bit better, but I would say 80% were people of color until recently. A couple more Caucasians have joined that. But it's nowhere near enough. 30 out of 435 House members, it's ridiculous. And almost nobody in the Senate. Bernie, a little bit Elizabeth Warren, but that's about it.
AIPAC, American Israel Public Affairs Committee, you were a member. What was that like? And does the lobby still have big influence in Washington? Recently, AIPAC helped defeat House Representatives Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman, both of whom were critics of Israel.
When AIPAC, I would get the literature every week, usually, and after about being a member for a year, and I had had my transformation, they called me up and I spoke with a woman who was a graduate student, and I said, you know what, I can't support AIPAC anymore unless they decide to make peace with Israel and they stop promoting violence against the Palestinians. And she goes, well, AIPAC only does what the Israeli government tells them to do. And I've heard that many times since. So AIPAC, in my opinion, is an arm of a foreign government. They should not be allowed to be a lobbyist group in the United States and donations to AIPAC, and AIPAC is extremely wealthy. Donations should not be tax deductible. They have so much influence in Congress. There are approximately 2 AIPAC lobbyists for every member of Congress. When a person gets elected to Congress, one of the first things is that person is meets with an AIPAC member. So Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush and obviously Rashida Tlaib and a few others have probably told these AIPAC members, go to hell. But they're so rare. And AIPAC has so much money, as proven with the defeat of Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman and Andy Levin. Andy Levin came from one of the most esteemed families in Michigan. He was a very popular congressman. He was, I think, president of a synagogue and the head of a Jewish organization. He was a Zionist, but he was a kind-hearted Zionist who recognized what Israel was doing was just really wrong, inhumane. But they defeated him. They got rid of him. They spent millions of dollars on the campaign and got rid of Andy Levin. The State of Israel, through AIPAC and other means, has such influence in the United States that I don't know if it's possible in any reasonable time frame to somehow stop that influence from its horrible effects. For example, Intel now calls itself as much an Israeli company as an American company. Israel has infiltrated Google, Microsoft, all the high-tech companies. They have, I guess, access to their core coding. They just have a lot of influence. They're influential in banks and also throughout universities, as we're seeing, because a lot of the donors are Jewish, and the donors are saying, you have to stop these nonviolent protests by a lot of Jewish kids who know that what Israel is doing is not only inhumane, but illegal. And they're kicking out college presidents, or even trying to get rid of professors who speak out against what Israel is doing.
But you see younger Jewish Americans being more critical.
Much more. Jewish Americans under the age of 40, a majority, do not accept what Israel is doing. They're critical of Israel.
Do you see Israel on its current path in danger of becoming isolated and a pariah state?
I do, and I see it possibly even in danger of civil war. As of 2 months ago, according to a number of media sources, including Israeli sources, 550,000 Jews have left Israel. At least 80% have said they will not return. Hundreds of businesses have closed, many businesses are going bankrupt, and the concentration of the religious fanatics in Israel is much higher today than it was 11 months ago. And that continues to happen because not that many Jews are going to want to move to Israel because they're worried for their safety. But the religious Jews who think that it's their holy land and they need to be there, they're the ones who are going to move there. And so that population will keep expanding. And of course, they have a much higher birth rate than the non-Orthodox Jews in Israel. So who knows? I think it'll be long, like Ilan Pappe and a number of people think that Israel is going to really implode. If they do, I think it'll take a lot longer than Elon and some of the others are predicting it will take.
Norway, Ireland, and Spain in late May recognized Palestine. The General Assembly votes in the UN on admitting Palestine are literally laughable. I mean, the votes are like 160-10, 170-8, those small numbers being the US, Israel, and some powerful Pacific Island nations.
Marshall Islands, Palau, Nauru.
Yeah. What do you see happening there internationally with more and more countries like Colombia, like Brazil, speaking out against what Israel is doing to the Palestinians?
I think it's good, but unless the United States gets involved, I don't think that any of these countries will really be able to get Israel to change its behavior. The United States, which they could have done years ago, has to demand that Israel stop and end all illegal activity and all violations of international law. But that would mean ending the occupation. And Israel wants the land. They're not occupying the Palestinian people for security reasons. If they really wanted security, they would have accepted they would have accepted numerous peace plans beginning in 1948, but they would have at least accepted the Arab Peace Initiative that has been on the table since 2002, would provide security guarantees for every state in the region, would provide Israel with diplomatic relations with every one of the 57 Muslim nations on earth, and would create a peace on the 1967 border, but that's negotiable. Even the former head of Mossad, he said, look, if Israel would give the Palestinians 97% of the West Bank, allow a nominal number between 20 and 30,000 Palestinians to return to Israel proper, and give Palestinians their civil rights, they could make peace. But Israel wants the land. They've been willing to sacrifice Jews in favor of the land. They've always been willing to sacrifice Jews. They've always wanted the land. They originally wanted a greater Israel, which was Syria, most of Lebanon, Jordan, Transjordan at the time, and all of Palestine. That was their goal. And Russia and the United States in the 1950s, when Ben-Gurion started talking about this, almost kicked Israel out of the United Nations. But then Ben-Gurion, you know, modified his language.
Talk about two young Americans. In February, Aaron Bushnell, a 25-year-old Air Force serviceman, immolated himself in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington. His last words were, "Free Palestine." And then in early September, Ayşenur Egi, a 26-year-old Turkish-American woman, was shot and killed by the Israeli military while at a peaceful protest in the village of Beta near Nablus in the occupied West Bank. Her death reminded some of another young American woman, peace activist Rachel Corrie, who was crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer in Gaza in 2003. Again, there's been no accountability for that.
Not only has there been no accountability, the Israeli courts exonerated the bulldozer driver, even though he saw her and deliberately drove over her. And then when the Corrie sued the state of Israel, the judge threw their lawsuit out also. And the reasoning was she was not an Israeli soldier, therefore she's an enemy combatant. That was basically the reason why the driver, the bulldozer driver, was exonerated.
A handful of U.S. government workers have resigned in protest of Washington's support of Israel and its Gaza war. Why haven't there been more resignations and protests? What's happening in Gaza and the West Bank is happening in broad daylight, in plain sight.
There's a couple reasons. Number one is Israel's narrative has been around for decades, generations, right? It has infiltrated the minds of most of Americans, whereas the Arab, what the Israelis call Arab, you know, because they don't refer to Palestinians as Palestinians, they don't want to acknowledge their identity, so they lump them into one category. But with 9/11, for example, and ISIS and Al-Qaeda, the Arabs have really gotten a very, very bad reputation. And some of it is deserved, but the fact is that a much lower percentage of Muslims support terrorism than Jews or Christians. The Gallup organization did a poll, and they found out that Christians and Jews support, in certain situations, terrorist acts at about double the rate of Muslims. But there's a billion, what is there? There's almost 2 billion Muslims in the world. So it only takes 1% to have, 200,000 terrorists. My point is that the Israeli narrative has infiltrated society to such an extent for so long that a lot of people simply take things for granted. When you hear Biden or Joe Scarborough or a lot of people talk about the Israelis and the Palestinians, they just automatically talk about Palestinians like they're terrorists, like it's just common knowledge, like that's who they are. They have never studied the history. They haven't had the decency to study the history and find out what really is going on.
What's happening mostly under the radar in the occupied West Bank? Since October 7th, there are close to 700 Palestinian dead, many more wounded, and thousands in prisons where, according to a documented B'Tselem report, there is torture. Incidentally, the BBC recently had a report on Israeli settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank.
Oh, it's horrible, horrible what they're doing. Under Ben-Gvir has the torture sessions from the worst of the prisons. He has them live stream video to his house so he can watch. They ordered the prisons to virtually starve them to death, to dehydrate them to death, to keep them chained 24 hours a day, no sunlight, and they're committing psychological and physical torture to these people. A lot of the prisoners have had their shackles so tight that, and the Israeli guards wouldn't remove them, that they've had to have limbs amputated. This is their revenge. Israel is seeking vengeance. They want vengeance on the Palestinians for what they did on October 7th, for what the Amalekites did on October 7th. So they think it's justified. I'll give you an example of how psychotic this view is. And you know, and I'm not anti-Israeli, and I'm not pro-Palestinian. I'm pro-human rights and anti-oppression. But to give you an example, there was a book written a number of years ago by two Orthodox rabbis called The King's Torah. And it was very popular in Israel. But when some of the secular organizations in Israel got angry at what it said, they were defended by a whole lot of other rabbis. What it said was that there's a term in Judaism called Yetzirah, which is the evil inclination. And Yetzahatov is the good inclination. And all human beings are born with Yetzirah and Yetzahatov. So according to the King's Torah, it is an act of compassion to kill Palestinian infants because they will grow up to be terrorists. And by killing them, you are ridding them of their Yetzirah, their evil inclination. This is how twisted some of these people have gotten. And these people are getting to be the mainstream of Israeli society. Ben-Gavir and Smotrich basically represent these people. And I just want to point out, one of the reasons Netanyahu, not that he wants to, but Netanyahu cannot create a ceasefire, cannot go along with a ceasefire if he wants to remain prime minister. Netanyahu's ideology is very similar to Ben-Gavir and Smotrich. It's just that they're religious and Netanyahu is not. But Netanyahu basically agrees with everything they want to do, which is expel through murder or population transfer, expel the indigenous people. And they would prefer murder. They would prefer murder because a dead Palestinian cannot commit a crime like was committed on October 7th.
The U.S. is an imperial power. It has military bases all over the Middle East. Washington is in bed with autocrats like Sisi in Egypt, monarchs in Jordan, emirs and sheikhs in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates. How does Israel figure in U.S. military calculations in the region?
If the United States is committed, has an ironclad commitment to Israel to make sure that Israel maintains its existence and is able to defend itself against foreign invaders, the United States is always going to make sure that its best friend in the Middle East is able to maintain hegemony in the Middle East. And that's one of the reasons why the United States is so antagonistic to Iran. The United States could speak more with Iran. You know, George Bush ignored the president of Iran, who was willing to make a treaty with the United States. They wanted, the Iranians were willing to create a nuclear-free Middle East, right? Of course, a nuclear-free Middle East means that Israel would have to give up its weapons because Israel is the only nuclear power in the Middle East. But my point is that the Iranians are willing to engage with Israel and with the Americans. Ehud Barak, the former defense minister, former prime minister, said, they're not irrational. They're mashuganas, but they're not irrational. Mashugan is the Yiddish word for crazy. So he considers them crazy, but he admits that they're not irrational.
What steps can be taken to alleviate or to address the roots of the conflict?
That's a very interesting question, because normally I would say education is absolutely necessary. We have to educate Americans, and somehow you got to get the education to start teaching Israelis not just the roots of the problem, but the fact that we all share a common humanity. So education doesn't work, okay? There have been probably thousands of studies that show that if you take someone with strongly held beliefs and you show them irrefutable evidence that their beliefs are wrong, they embrace their beliefs more tenaciously, okay? It doesn't affect them at all. So the two things that I think should be taught in school, but again, Israel would rebel against this because the parents wouldn't want to go for it, are nonviolent communication, the work of Marshall Rosenberg, and the work of Byron Katie. Those things teach people to be responsible for their feelings, that no one else is responsible for their fear, no one else is responsible for their anger, and they teach, and in Byron Katie's case in particular, they teach projection. They teach how you are seeing the world as a projection. What you claim is true of someone else is often true of yourself. And these spiritual practices, because that's what they really are when you really get into them, these spiritual practices really need to change the consciousness of our society. Otherwise, we're going to destroy ourselves. Even leaving Israel aside, we're going to destroy ourselves if we don't learn to live together and learn to take responsibility for our beliefs and images and learn that, yes, you're a Jew, you're a Christian, you're a Muslim, you're a Hindu, whatever, but at heart, there is no separation, and you are a human being who happens to have been born into a Jewish, Christian, Hindu, you know, Muslim family. We all share a common humanity. I want to mention one of the principles I discovered, which is that the root of suffering is the attachment to a presumed, limited, and mortal identity and to the beliefs and images that emanate from and reinforce that presumption. If someone were to take that definition and apply it to every situation where they see conflict, they would be able to understand what is going on to a far greater degree. And then a corollary to that is that the real enemy is not someone or something outside of us. The real enemy is the unexamined and dualistic mind that unconsciously projects its suffering onto the other and then blames and scapegoats the other for its suffering. That's what we're doing all the time. Yes, some people are more cruel and vicious and dishonest and unconscious than others. In fact, to a very large extent, the battle between what some people will call pro-Palestinians and pro-Israelis is a battle between consciousness and unconsciousness. My friends, my relatives who still support Israel and everybody else I met, they want to remain unconscious. They will not read a book. They want to believe the myths that they were fed. They want to believe the false ideas that they have created in their own minds, rather than challenge who they think they are. And the reason they won't challenge who they think they are is, at a deeper level, it's death. They're challenging the mortality. So their identity is so extremely tied with Israel that when you criticize Israel, it's as if you're criticizing them. If Israel is unfair and inhumane, they're unfair and inhumane. And all that it takes is to just wake up and read a book. I've told my friends, why don't you read a book? No one has to know you're reading the book. You can read the book in the comfort of your own home. And you can put the book down whenever you feel like it. And they won't do it. They won't even read my book. Not only will they not read my book, but they know that I've studied the subject for thousands of hours. But they think they know more than me, even though they haven't studied it for more than a minute. This is the dilemma. This is not an exaggeration. These people, I'm not just talking about my friends, I'm talking about everybody, practically. When we talk about Israel and Palestine, yes, the so-called pro-Israel side, they don't know what they're talking about. They cling to myths. They refuse to find the history. I've never met anyone who supports Israel who actually has read the history, who really studies the history, other than a couple historians like Benny Morris, who believes that Palestinians are serial killers and psychopaths. But so it's like the KKK. They're willing to admit they hate Jews and Catholics and African Americans. And by the way, Tamir Pardo, the former head of Mossad, has called today's Israeli government much worse than the KKK. So it's a huge dilemma, and it's an existential threat to the world. It's, you know, as I say, existential fear and confusion is the main disposition of human beings, but the irony is that the unexamined and dualistic mind is self-destructive in nature. It will create, being dualistic, it will create the opposite condition to which it claims it wants. This is why these spiritual practices are necessary. And it doesn't have to be Byron Katie and NVC. There are many other wonderful spiritual practices from religions, mostly from the East, in my opinion, but people need to embrace a spiritual practice and start learning about their own minds.
Thanks very much for your
time. Thank you, David.
You were just listening to Richard Florer, Blaming the Victim, Roots of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. I talked with him in mid-September at the Boulder Public Library. Richard Florer is a former member of AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. He's the author of the New York Big Book Award, Wake Up and Reclaim Your Humanity, on the tragedy of Israel-Palestine. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Noura Eraket, Ilan Pape, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Richard Forer, Blaming the Victim, Roots of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, and for his award-winning book, Wake Up and Reclaim Your Humanity, on the Tragedy of Israel-Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Mary Fitzgerald and to the Boulder Public Library. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with the Kronos Quartet with Hamza al-Din performing Water Wheel.